What's going on, everybody? I'd like to welcome y'all back to Sync Music Mondays, man. My favorite day of the week and your favorite day of the week. That's why you here, man. Shout out to my brother JS, aka The Best, man. As y'all always know, he normally does our intros for us, but unfortunately he couldn't be here at the moment, but it's all good. We holding it down. And for starters, y'all always know what it is, man. We always start off with the word of the week, something inspirational, motivational to get you to start off your week. And here is the word of the day. Y'all gonna see it up on the screen today. The word of the day is pray about it as much as you think about it. I'm gonna say that one more time. Pray about it as much as you think about it. I think that that word of the day is pretty much common sense. You know, a lot of times people get caught up in stress, anxiety, different pressures that they go through and experience in life. But it's very important that as much as you worry about it, hold your focus, you know, don't let your emotions control you, because that's when you tend to lose control. There's a saying that I love, man. It goes, you know, always move with strategy, never emotion. So obviously we human beings, our emotions tend to take us different ways, but always try to just take a step back, take a deep breath and refocus. And that is the word of the day. But aside from that, today we have a very, very special, dope guest, man. He is a boss. He's a businessman. He's an entrepreneur. He's a business owner. I mean, he does it all, man. It's no other than the GOAT, the legend, Tariq Bradford. What's up, man? Yeah, man. Yeah, of course, man. Look, we appreciate you. We appreciate you taking out the time. And, you know, you're just so accomplished, man. So we just wanted to kind of just dive in, just kind of talk about your past accomplishments, your present accomplishments, and all the sorts.
Cool. No, sounds good. And thanks for having me. I appreciate you wanting to speak to me and letting me tell a little bit about my story and kind of the things that are going on with me and my company and everything. So I'm looking forward to having a conversation with you and just kind of shooting the shit.
Most definitely. Most definitely, man. So, you know, I kind of gave the people like a glossed overview of you. But for the people that might necessarily not know who you are, they might be hearing about you for the first time. Could you tell them in your own words exactly who you are?
Sure. I'll do a little intro myself. My name's Tariq Bradford. I run a music licensing and publishing company called Dahomey Music, and specialize in getting artists that we represent music placed in film, television, commercials, and video games. And I've been doing that for about 23 years now, and been in the music industry almost 30 years now, and had my own company for about 10 years. So before that, I worked at several major labels and publishers, and just kind of building up, you know, experience and learning the business and networking and getting to learn people. So I guess I'll start at the beginning. I grew up in the LA area and in West Covina, about 20 miles from downtown LA. And I always wanted to work in the music industry. It was always something that was pretty close by, but I didn't have any connections to it. I didn't know anybody. It was just kind of like something, you driving off a freeway, you would see the Capitol building off the 101, or going to Burbank, you'd see the Warner Brothers building. And I was always fascinated as a kid with people like Berry Gordy and Russell Simmons, Eazy-E. And I always wanted to work in music, but I didn't know how to go about it. So when I was in college, I just started going into intern at different record companies and really just different entertainment companies. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, because I think like a lot of people, the only thing that I really knew about the music industry were like the big stars and like the biggest executives. So like Russell Simmons, Berry Gordy, Dick Griffey, who ran Solar Records. I knew their names, but I didn't know what other people did. And then you kind of knew like A&R positions, but I didn't even really know what that meant. I just knew like, oh, they got to work with the artist and work with music and then radio. So I just started taking any internships I could when I was in college and just getting in wherever I could to learn as much as I can. So I interned at a management company, at a radio station. I did college radio. I interned at Paramount Pictures, Virgin Records, and just a bunch of different places just to try and gather information and see where I might fit in the picture. And so my first gig was working at Virgin Records when it used to be a record label. And I was working in the urban music department in promotions. And it was basically getting all of the artists on the roster, trying to get the music out to people. I was basically a gopher, which meant I bounced from department to department depending on what people needed. So if the head of promotions wanted to do, you know, get a bunch of posters out for Janet Jackson's new release, I would get everything organized, ship things out, arrange travel for like the Ghetto Boys or Luther Vandross or whoever, just all the little crappy jobs that nobody wants to do, like on the entry level. So I did that and got a chance to just learn the industry, learn what people were doing, learn what I did or didn't want to do. And then, so I was there for maybe 3.5 years. And then at that time, the industry consolidated. A bunch of labels got bought up. Virgin got bought by EMI. And basically that whole office closed and everybody got laid off. So I had worked some in promotions and A&R just as an assistant. And I figured, well, there's going to be a lot of people unemployed who are looking for the same thing that I am. And I don't have that much experience, so I better learn something else as well. So I went on a bunch of interviews and I got an interview at Warner Music Group to do something called A&R licensing, which is basically putting together compilations for packages. Now, somebody who is like 22 would go like compilations, but this is before Spotify or Apple Music or any of that. And when people would sell physical copies of compilations, so like Billboard hits, hair bands of the 90s, R&B hits of the 90s, Motown hits of the 70s, all of those compilations, sometimes you get them at truck stops or you just see the commercials late at night and it'd be like a bunch of your favorite songs depending on what style you like. And so they needed somebody to handle the licensing for that. And that, just for people who may not know exactly what licensing is somebody controls the rights to a song. And if somebody wants to use that song, in this case on a compilation, they have to go to the rights owner. Somebody controls the publishing and somebody controls the master recording. And so I worked at the record company, which is, technical old terms, is the master recording. So that's Warner Music Group. So anything that fell under that umbrella, I would handle licensing for that, for compilations, for greeting cards, for anything like singing teddy bears, toothbrushes that played music. I would license it, including soundtracks too. So a soundtrack from a film, I would, you know, the film would say, we want to license a song. It may not necessarily be in the film, but they may want the song for the soundtrack. So I would license the song for that. And then I continued doing that. And along the way, I started doing sample clearance. I had a background loving DJing and just digging through the crates and knowing that. And it was really a job nobody wanted to do. So it was to identify the samples as they came in, the request from the sample clearance person, and then go to who was sampled, ask their permission, and ask them what they wanted the fee to be. So I added that as well. So I did that for a few years. And then as things went along, I wanted to add more to what I was doing because there are different areas of licensing. That was called audio licensing. And then visual is kind of where we transition to now, which is anything film or television related. So there are two separate departments, but they were on the same floor. And then the same person ran both departments. So I basically transferred from that department over to the visual department and picked up different clients. And, you know, you could kind of see the writing on the wall. This is right around the time of downloading and, you know, physical products starting to go away. So I didn't want to be stuck just doing compilation licensing when you could kind of see the writing on the wall that that was going to go away eventually on some level. So I went over to the visual department, which is film, television, commercials, as well as video games. And this was about 2000 and 2006. So I went over there, still at Warner Music Group, still at the same company, but just different clients and reporting to a different person. And so my job with that was now pitching music for television. I was focused on television and all of the labels that fell under that umbrella. So that could be a Warner Records artist like Prince or Green Day, or it could be an artist on Elektra like Missy Elliott, or catalog artists as well. So Ray Charles, Led Zeppelin, The Doors. So anything under that umbrella for a TV show, I would pitch to several music supervisors and also clear anything that they were coming, that they wanted. Sometimes they might want a song that doesn't clear. They might ask me, hey, do you have a song to replace this? Maybe Prince didn't clear. Do you have anything similar to that? So I was there for a total of about 8 years. And then I got an offer to go to Universal on the label side to head up their creative department that they were just kind of launching. Creative meaning to be more proactive with pitching the songs, because kind of in the early stages, licensing was a lot of just reactive. People would come and say, hey, we want a song, we want to license it, what do you charge us for it? And that was it. As that started to generate a lot more money, the label started to say, let's be proactive and find out what they're looking for and see if we can get some songs placed that maybe they aren't looking for or don't know about, whether it's hidden gems or some of our new up and coming artists. So Universal wanted to grow that area, and so they brought me on to head that department up. So I started over there in maybe 2008, and it was similar to what I was doing at Warner, but just expanded. So I was the head of creative. So it was not only television now, but film, video games, commercials, and it was my job to pitch anything in the Universal catalog, which would include Motown, Interscope, Def Jam, any of those artists. And around that time, Lil Wayne was hot. Lady Gaga was just getting signed. Amy Winehouse was big. So just a variety of artists from all those different labels. They had just signed a new kid named Drake, Justin Bieber. So it was a bunch of those different artists. A lot of them were new. So you're trying to get people to license their songs if it fits, but then also the catalog songs and other songs that are there that are lesser known. And just basically trying to find whatever the supervisor is looking for. I usually kind of compare it to being a bartender, where whatever people are coming for, you want to make sure that you're stocked up in that. So if somebody wants, you know, malt liquor, you make sure that you have it. If they want white wine, you make sure that you have it. And you don't try, if somebody, you have a certain party that wants a certain thing, you make sure that you give them what they're looking for and not just what you're trying to push. And that's one of the things that I learned early in my career, was not to try to shove things on people that don't fit. If they are asking you for a up-tempo hip hop song, you don't want to send them a country song. Or if they're asking for a down-tempo singer-songwriter kind of folk song, you don't want to send them, you know, a slow, sexy R&B song. You want to send them what they're looking for. And so I was there for a couple of years doing that, and then they had layoffs at Universal, so I went over to, I'd never worked on the publishing side. I'd always been on the label side. So I thought, you know, and I always had ambition to have my own company, but part of working in at different labels and companies was learning how to do that and how to get that established. And, you know, not coming from, you know, a family with money, how do I get funding? How do I even get that launched? So I thought, you know what, I should learn the publishing side more. I knew some of the basics, but I had never worked at a publishing company. So an opportunity came up at EMI Music Publishing, and EMI had just combined with Capitol. So they were pitching masters and publishing at the same time. So I went over there 2010 or 11, and, you know, I started learning the publishing side. At that time, what was big there? Kanye, Jay, of course, Rihanna. So there was a lot of big songs, but also a lot of up-and-coming artists like Sia, who went on to become really big. But at the time, she was a kind of an unknown writer. So it's a lot of that. It's not just focusing on the big songs, because a lot of times the big songs may not even work for film or TV, or the budgets may not fit for it. So you're trying to place whatever fits, whether it's mid-tier, really well-known, or up and coming. So I was there for a couple of years, and then as that was ending, it was kind of like the Titanic, where you knew that iceberg was coming around the corner. The company was up for sale. And so I started setting up my company and getting ready to transition into being, you know, on my own. And 2012 was when I started the Homie Music. And I basically started just working with people that I knew, that I had met from the labels. My first client, I think, was Stampede Management, which is Snoop's management company. And so they had Snoop, Macy Gray, a young, really young YG, and a bunch of other different artists. And so I started working with them. We had known each other for years because they had managed a bunch of different artists at both of the labels I had worked at. So I got to know the team over there and become, like, you know, really good friends with them. And so I told them, they had reached out to me and said, hey, we're looking for somebody to pitch some of our artists. Can you do that for them? And at the time, they didn't know I had just been laid off. So I said, well, the timing is perfect because I'm looking for clients. And they had a bunch of up and coming artists, as well as the bigger artists who were either in label deals or publishing deals, or just in label deals and maybe didn't have anybody on the publishing side. So I would go in and pitch them, and they gave me some names to walk in the door with as I was kind of building my company. And my idea for my company was to build it similar to what I had experienced at the majors, which is have a little bit of everything so that people have a reason to come to you for a variety of songs. So even though a lot of people know me for, you know, really knowing hip hop well and R&B and soul music, I also, like a DJ, want to be versatile. And if you need a country song or a metal song, like, I know that music well also. So I just started accumulating different clients that fit these needs and fit these holes. So it might be a management company, it might be just an independent artist, or it might be an independent label or publishing company. So, like, Downtown Records, who at the time had Gnarls Barkley and Cold War Kids, I brought them on as a client. Bridgeport Publishing, which is all of the George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic music, and the Ohio Players, and a lot of that stuff out of Detroit from the 70s. And then I just started continuing to add clients and build them up. Some that I would just meet through friends and networking and manager friends, some just searching out on my own and just building up a roster of a variety of artists. And then just over the years, I just continue to just build up relationships, because some catalogs come and go. Some it's, well, this doesn't work out, or the expectations are different, because a lot of people tend to think that their music is perfect for sync, no matter what it sounds like. And I always have to refer to back to that bartender analogy of, if people aren't coming for it, then that's just kind of the way it is. It's not really a matter of you forcing people to like a certain style or of a song. It's what's in demand. So you build up these relationships and companies and just kind of find the ones that fit the best. So I have hip hop labels that I represent. I have independent kind of electronic labels. My biggest client is probably CD Baby. And so I have all these different labels, as well as just artists that I have relationships over the years that I have write directly for film and TV. I might put them with a producer, and then we'll co-publish that song and then try to get it placed for film or for television, and then, you know, move forward from that and just kind of build up a catalog and represent different artists in different styles and different lanes, all still while trying to stay true to, like, my vision of having songs that really fit well for film and television, and, you know, getting people whatever they need. So that kind of just brings us to where we are today. So I had my company now for about 10 years, and it's still continuing to build, and now just trying to build smartly, and not, things build up fast and you end up taking on a lot more than maybe you should. So just trying to streamline things and make sure that everything stays organized and that grow at the pace that I want on the publishing side, as well as on the film and TV representation side.
Yeah, well, you know, that's amazing, man. Like, I mean, and within that, you have so many gems, man. I like the bartender thing, because that's one thing that we got so many artists globally that listen to our show. And that's one thing that we always talk about, like having the ability to be diverse. And that's important because, like you said, if you go to the bar, some people might like Moet. They want champagne. Some people might like dark liquor. They want Henny. So you can't force what you got going on them just because that might be, you know, your angle. You know what I'm saying? So, yo, that's a big gem, man. That's a huge gem. And kind of to backtrack, I like the fact that you were able to pivot so much. Like, you know, just as you were able to see the writing on the wall to see, all right, things are changing, I got to pivot. And I think that's critical too, like for artists to be successful, especially in the industry. You know, we saw the evolution, you know, going from tape cassettes to CDs to MP3s, then the streaming era. Things are constantly evolving, constantly changing. And like they say, you know, the only constant is change, right? Whether in business or life. So having that ability and that mental fortitude to say, yo, I got to pivot, I got to do something different, because if not, you know, you're gonna be like the dinosaurs, you're gonna be out of here, you know.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. I usually, when I talk to artists, I tell them, like, as a businessman and as an executive on my side, I'm doing the same thing that you're doing, just behind the scenes. I'm trying to grow, I'm trying to still at the same time stay true to who I am and not do anything outside of what I'm comfortable doing, but still be open to change and growing, because you have to, because otherwise, like you said, you're still stuck in a past gone era and, you know, complaining about things that you have no control over, whether it's technology or changes in music or certain style. We all have things that we're passionate about from a certain time that fit a certain thing, but you also have to continue to grow and learn and find out, okay, where can I fit in that? It doesn't mean change up and try to be outside of who you are. And that's what I usually tell artists is, don't try to just jump on trends, just try to find your lane. And for sync licensing, it doesn't mean that lane means you'll get a ton of licenses, but it can give you kind of the best chance to get licenses, and at least you're aware of what people are looking for. So that's usually what I try to tell people. It doesn't mean change your style or try to be another artist, but it's just things to be aware of. Tips, no different than you want your song on the radio. You know, any A&R person worth their weight would tell you, well, you need to probably have like a strong hook. You need to have something that people can sing along to. And that's basically as old as the music industry, whether it's an Elvis song or a Drake song. The songs that we all know the most are the songs with a solid hook. Mm-hmm. That hasn't changed, and it probably won't change. It doesn't mean that that's the only songs, but when you go through radio hits that we all know, songs that we just start singing, melodies that we all know, there's, you know, a synergy that exists there that you have to pay attention to. And then also pay attention to trends and kind of what's going on and be aware. I'm constantly listening to music, whether it's music I might want to represent or just staying up to date on what's going on or what the latest trend is, whether it's I like it or I don't like it. I have to be aware of it, whether it's talking to other artists, talking to my kid, talking to nieces, nephews, whoever, and just kind of, you know, I pick their brains. What are you listening to? Watching shows, seeing what fits for different shows, and just kind of being aware of what's going on culturally. Some things are bubbling that haven't broken out yet that you kind of see coming, and you want to get in front of that, because a lot of times a supervisor might ask you, which is kind of a difficult question to answer, can you pitch me a song that's going to be hot in 6 months or that's going to be hot in 9 months? And if we could do that, I'd be a billionaire. Right. But there is something to say, like, oh, you know what? A lot of times mainstream is a little bit behind what's bubbling on the underground. So you might see something bubbling, for example, like Afrobeats. Right now, people are now catching on to Afrobeats. But years ago, you're listening to Burna Boy and all these different artists, like, man, if this can catch the right wave at the right time, and this can do well. And now you're starting to get a few more requests in film and TV for Afrobeats, whereas 3-4 years ago, you would never get that. So you just kind of try and anticipate things like that, trends and things that you might see coming, as well as paying attention to what's going on right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, you know, just being aware, having that hindsight, understanding, like, all right, you know, you see it coming, you see the trends, and paying attention. Like, a lot of times, I know I used to do that. Like, I got hip to actually just paying attention to the music, because when you're so used to watching TV, watching film, a lot of times it's like, all right, you know, you're paying attention to it, but people don't really understand or comprehend how much music is utilized in the course of a TV show. You know what I'm saying? And as you look at those transitional scenes, and you know, whether you got a dramatic scene, you got an action-packed scene, there's a lot of music in there. So for like all the artists that's listening to the show, you know, that's definitely another gem that you dropped, is just, you know, being aware. You know, don't just watch TV, don't just go to the movies as a spectator. You can enjoy it, but also as a musician, like, be aware, like, okay, what type of sounds are they using? You know, what type of style is relevant? You know, what's going on? So that's a gem, man.
Yeah, that'll help artists a lot too. And I think it will help artists to be honest as well. Because most people, it's rare that you hear people say, no, my music doesn't work for film and TV. Most people think their music does work. But a good way to kind of tell if what you're doing are certain songs that you think work is to pay attention to the shows, to watch the shows, listen to the music, see some of the trends, because you'll see a lot of the same things, even when different shows. And if you have a certain style of music, how often do you hear that style in a TV show or in a film or in a commercial? And pay attention to that. There's a website that I would recommend artists check out that's free and open to anybody. It's called TuneFind. And it's a list of, and it's not every single show, but it's a pretty good gauge of the shows and the songs that are played in each show. It's just called TuneFind. You just go on there and you can pull up Insecure and see, oh, what was the song used in season 1, episode 4? And it'll show you the song, and they'll even play like 15 seconds of the song. So that way artists can look and see, like, if you think your music works for this, compare it to the songs that were used from season to season, and honestly assess, hey, does that fit what they're looking for? And that will give you kind of like a good way to come up with a strategy of shows or music supervisors to target if you think it's a good fit. But you still have to be honest. You can't think that if you're a death metal band that your song works for a show like Grey's Anatomy. Yeah. That's just not going to happen. You have to have a little bit of honesty about yourself and what your sound is, and see. And sometimes it might be limited. For a lot of artists, that might be a limited window. Maybe there's only 4 or 5 shows that use the kind of music that you have. If you're a reggae artist, there are not a ton of shows that use reggae outside of huge iconic songs. I usually tell people that reggae isn't big in sync. People don't usually come and say, oh, we want a reggae song. They want a Bob Marley song.
Right.
So unless it's a show set in the islands or a specific area, reggae isn't a genre that gets used a ton. It doesn't mean that it never gets used, but it's not something that you just hear on a regular basis in film and television.
Right. No, that's, you dropping gems, man. It's a lot of gems. So, you know, all the artists listening to this, man, you know, take notes, man. Get your pens out, get your pads, you know, because it's a lot of gems, man. You know, circling back, I know you said that you named your company the Homie Music. I'm just curious, like, what made you come up with that name? Was it because it was your peoples, you was close to the homies, or like, what kind of went into that?
It was because it's two reasons. The main reason is the Homie Empire, which was, you know, a well-known empire. Well, I guess not that well-known. It's modern-day Benin, but in college, I was a Pan-African Studies major. So Pan-African Studies is just the study of basically Black people all around the world. So empires and kingdoms of Africa always fascinated me. So it was time to name my company, I wanted something. First, I was just going to name it like Bradford, and now it's like, that's kind of just like, I want something that is about me but is separate from me. Mm-hmm. And so when I just started going through things, I went through song titles and a bunch of other things and just trying to find something that really stood out to me. And then I started going through some of my old college papers that I was cleaning out one day, and it was one that I had to do on different empires. And different nations. And I was going through, and then there were a few, the AO Empire, and then the Homie Empire. And I was kind of going back and forth between those two. And then I thought, you know, the Homie, people are going to assume, especially being black, being into hip hop, that it's the homie, as in the homies.
Right.
And I kind of like that. I kind of like the dual meaning of that, that people will see it and it kind of sparks, you know, like interest and conversation and like, oh, hey, that's cool. And then it also is kind of gives me like a hint into somebody when they see that and they go, oh, like the Dahomey Empire, like recently. And, you know, I named it this like 10 years ago. And then, of course, Black Panther came out, and then the Dora Milaje are based on the Dahomey Amazon women. And so it was like, oh, that was kind of cool to see. And then the Warrior King, the Warrior Queen movie came out earlier this year, and that's based on the Dahomey Empire. So it ended up now more people. I had, when the movie was about to come out, I had more people that I just know reach out and just say, who, people who never asked and said, oh, now I get why you named your company that. I thought it was, you know, just like the homies. Right. So it ended up being cool. Like, I never in my life thought that there would be a movie on the Dahomey Empire. I just thought it was a great name and it stood out to me. And the just kind of the whole empire thing and always fascinated me. And then the name just looked like it just fit when I wrote it down on a piece of paper. So I went with it because of that.
That's amazing. And look, full disclosure, when I read it, I thought, like, you know, because we from the hood, I was like, oh, the homies, right? I'm like, you know, because that's what you automatically think. So that's actually, yeah, that's a gem, man. I didn't even know, man. So now I'm...
And I like that kind of dual feeling to it, because I'm dealing with, you know, a lot of the homies, a lot of people who, you know, listen to hip hop and are in the hood, and that's the first thing. And so I felt like when you see that, there's kind of like a feeling of comfort when you see that, like, oh, okay, I know what this is about. And then for other people who might know about the empire, it's, oh, I know what this company might, or that person might be about. So it kind of serves two different purposes. And I feel like,
yeah,
duality. And I feel like that's, especially for black people in America, that's kind of our existence, is you exist in these two worlds where you got to be able to communicate with the fam, with the homies, and then you got to be able to communicate on a business level, on a broader level. So that was the main reason, is I like that kind of duality, and that it can mean two different things to two different people, but it means both.
Yeah, no, that's fire, man. That's fire. And, you know, to kind of backtrack a little bit, because something you said, man, that's it's real prolific. Like, you know, I feel like a lot of times minorities, especially black people, like, we put in positions where we got a code switch, you know, like you said. So it's like, you know, when you're in the hood, you walk, you talk a certain way, you feel more comfortable. Corporate America, you kind of got to, you know, toe the line a little bit to make sure that, you know, you don't come off too abrasive, too aggressive. So, you know, that's a question that I have for you, like, you know, especially being a black man, a business owner, clearly successful because your company's been around for so long. Like, what challenges have you faced, like, being a black business owner, especially in the music licensing space? You know, because I see, like, you know, I always feel like representation matters. And we'll get into the other company that you have going on with, for, you know, promoting black artists and stuff like that. We'll get into that. But, you know, for starters, like, just as a black business owner, you know, what challenges have you faced?
To be honest, I feel like there's always challenges. Anytime you start any business, there's a challenge. But I feel like the timing for me was perfect, because my initial goal as a teenage kid was like, I want a record label. But people don't know, different today now, having a record label is incredibly expensive for manufacturing, process, and all that. But then for me, doing licensing and publishing, it's intellectual property. So all I really need every day is my computer and my relationships. So it's not that it's been easy, but it's the time that I started was definitely easier than 10 years before, when there weren't as many independent companies. And then because the industry got smaller and smaller, it kind of forced a lot of people to go independent. And at that point, I had been in the business for over 15 years, so I had a lot of relationships. But your first thought, at least my first thought, is when I'm going on my own, will people call me back? Mm-hmm. Now that I don't have the new Kanye, the new Green Day, the new Coldplay, you know, you basically have to come to somebody at a major because they have so many huge artists and so many hits that whether you want to or not, as well as catalog. Like if you're doing a movie like, what was the series, Mad Men, like you can't avoid coming to me. I worked at EMI. We had the Beatles and Motown. Mm. And it was set in the 60s. There's no way to avoid that if you're trying to be authentic to that era. Right. So you have to come and get that. But now going on my own, when it's lesser known tracks and you don't have to come to me, my main concern was, will people call me back? Mm. And surprisingly, I have to, you know, credit the industry that I'm in, is there's a lot of people who will look out for each other. Once you're in and you kind of establish yourself and you have some level of respect and people know that you know your stuff, people have looked out. Like people took my calls. I can get on the phone with the head of Paramount or the head of music at Universal and basically all of the studios and say, hey, can I come in and pitch you my company and bring an artist by, or can you put me on the list for invites for screenings? Can you add me to your briefs? And I could say like 99% of the people did. So I think it's credit to them. And I like to feel like I did a lot of the legwork so that they trusted me to know like, hey, he knows this stuff and we enjoy working with him. Mm-hmm. So the difficult part was just building the business. It wasn't like obstacles of people trying to shut me down. It was more of just building it up and trying to do it in a smart way and learning. And I'm still learning and still trying to shape it and make sure that it makes sense moving forward, especially as there continue to be changes in the industry. Being in the music business was the difficult part because you're trying to climb a ladder. And you're trying to climb a ladder that is hard to get through without, you know, those connections. Man, I definitely ran into obstacles of being pigeonholed, being Black, and being somebody who knows and loves hip hop and R&B, but also knows and loves a lot of different music, of getting pigeonholed that you can't do these things. Mm. And or the other side of, I had people in the past tell me, well, basically don't wear so loud that you are, you know, a hip hop kid. Don't wear it so loud. You know, I'd show up to work with, you know, with my Public Enemy t-shirt or Wu-Tang or whatever I felt like that day, or a Bob Marley shirt, just what I was into. And I'm also into Nine Inch Nails and Red Hot Chili Peppers, but, you know, I would rock whatever shirt I was wearing. Posters in my office, it was Pac, it was NWA, it was the stuff that I just personally loved. And I was just myself while doing my job. And I got some pushback from some people who didn't tell me not to do this, but they recommended, like, you know, maybe you take that poster down, or, you know, maybe you're not good for this job because you only know this. And a lot of times it wouldn't be people saying it to your face because they don't want, people know that I'm outspoken and that I'll push back and that I don't just, you know, take what somebody says. I'll say it in a respectful way, but that I stand up for myself. So people would say it behind closed doors. And fortunately, what I always tell Black people is be yourself, but being yourself doesn't mean being hood or being any of that. Just be yourself. Like, mm-hmm. I'm who I am and I'm comfortable in that. And at the same time, I was fortunate enough to build relationships with people outside of our culture that were just good men and good women and basically allies. And I have white people who ask me all the time, especially like when everything went down with George Floyd and the industry was like, oh, what can we do? What can we do? And one of the things that I said in a post was be an ally to somebody, like truly be an ally and be an advocate. And if somebody is saying, you know, hey, we're looking for somebody for this position, and you know somebody that is Black that is qualified and good for that position, put them up for it. Not as a favor or anything like that, but because it's the right thing to do and they're good for the job. Absolutely. And if somebody is saying somebody can't do something, you know, I had a situation where people thought I couldn't do something because, you know, of how I present myself in their eyes. And I had, you know, people, I had an entire department almost stand up and say, no, you need to, it was going for a promotion. And basically the entire department, which none of them were Black, stood up and said, he's the best person for that.
Wow.
And so I think just building those coalitions while staying true to yourself and being professional and knowing your stuff and standing your ground and knowing which battles to fight, but still standing your ground. It's a difficult balance to go through. It's stuff that, you know, my pops would tell me and, like, you know, as they say, the elders tell you, but mm-hmm. you get in there and you're like, oh, this is what they were talking about. Okay. Especially dealing in corporate America. And, you know, there's a, you have to try and maneuver around it without, you know, basically getting pissed off. And it's really hard. You know, there were many days that I took a walk around the building just to calm down, come back, and then present what I had to say in a forceful manner, but without necessarily so much emotion, mm-hmm. because that from us gets classified a certain way, being overly right. aggressive. So I had to learn, especially when you're young, I had to learn, like, how to deliver the same message, but in a calm way.
Absolutely.
And when you do that, a lot of times that it's undeniable, because it's a lot easier to dismiss somebody when they're overly emotional compared to when they're calmly just explaining to you why you're wrong. That's kind of my advice.
That's a big gem, man. And you know what? I want to say I got to shout out Otis Williams, man, because the Temptations, they just put out their 60th anniversary record like a couple months back. And I did a track. Well, I did the first track on that record. And what you just said is what Otis was telling me when we were chopping it up. And he was like, you know, a lot of times it's not necessarily what you say, it's how you say it. You know, so in like you said, true to form, unfortunately for minorities, 99% of the time we get labeled as the angry Black man, the angry Black woman. And, you know, because those emotions come out. But it's very important, even in business dealings, being a business owner, a musician, being tactful, being intelligent and able to be articulate. So that way you get your point across, but you still don't come across aggressive, you know, or overly assertive at the same time, you know.
I read a lot, and I study just kind of people from the past, because, you know, like I always say, like, whatever I'm dealing with, somebody dealt with 10 times more than me 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, what my pops had to deal, I didn't have to deal with what my pops dealt with and what my grandpa dealt with. So it's like, I always try to keep that in mind and make sure that it's relative. Like, all right, this sucks right now, but what did my pops have to deal with? And what did he do? He powered through it. So, you know, I always try to remember that and keep that in mind. And even when just talking to older Black people, especially, and getting those lessons and, you know, kind of getting a perspective of something that I might think is unfair or not like, but compared to what they had to deal with, and it just kind of brings it full circle to be like, all right, now this is how I have to handle it, because there's people coming up behind me. You know, younger siblings, cousins, people, kids that are coming up behind me, and something that I do might either help or hurt them in the future. So just kind of keeping that in mind. And it's a lot to process, but I always feel like that's just been our journey in this country, and it's just what we have to do to survive, and not just survive, but prosper and maneuver and still try and stay somewhat sane.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Definitely, man. Definitely. You know, I wanted to pivot, because I wanted to ask you, because, you know, we kind of talked about the importance of just representation, especially in the music industry, music licensing. So I wanted to talk about the Sound Initiative, because I think that's so dope what you guys are doing with that. And I think, like, a lot of musicians, they're not aware of it. But we actually did an episode where we highlighted y'all and we talked about the Sound Initiative. So in your own words, for musicians that might be hearing about it for the first time, if they didn't hear the other show or whatever, could you tell them exactly what the Sound Initiative is?
Sure. Yeah, Sound Initiative is a not-for-profit panel that I'm a member of the board on. And it started maybe like a year and a half ago. I had a few people reach out to me and ask if I wanted to participate, because, like I said, people have known me over the years and I've never been shy about speaking my mind. So the goal of Sound Initiative is just to simply educate black musicians and artists who are trying to get into the music industry, just educate them about Sync, just so they know about it and are aware of it and are aware of some of the pitfalls and just some of the basics. Like, you, when you do something for a long time, you can get into a zone where you just assume things. Like, you start using lingo just because this is what you say every day. And then you run into somebody who's like, what's that? Or especially if somebody is new to the business. But, you know, so I thought, you know, this would be a great thing to be a part of, because it can just help educate artists to at least give them options and know what they're up against and know where to start. Because a lot of times as an artist, you don't even know where to start. Like, oh, hey, I hear songs and TV shows and films, or I hear people getting money for it. Like, how do I do that? And so I agreed to be a part of this organization just to have artists who would join. And basically what we're doing is just an educational kind of platform. We're trying to do, and we're doing a little bit of restructuring now that, not that COVID is over, but we're a little bit more free to do things because everything had been done on Zoom. We're just trying to set up just podcast, YouTube interviews, and just present the information and put it in a holding place so people can submit questions and then have their questions answered and then hold different panels. So we did one that was on licensing and TV music. So we had music supervisors who work on TV shows like Euphoria and a few other shows that people all know and are big fans of, The Wire, all these different shows. And we just had the music supervisors come on, and then me and a couple of the other panelists asked them questions about what they're looking for and what they're not looking for, and just kind of give them a breakdown for shows. And this one, because, you know, the target is black artists. So that one was about TV, and there are certain shows that everybody talks about, that everybody's buzzing about, especially a show like Insecure that used a lot of different music and introduced people to a lot of new artists. And so we had that supervisor and a few other people just on to talk about the process and then what they're looking for, what works and what doesn't work. And then the next panel we did was on music and commercials. So Sound Initiative is just kind of an educational organization. And also we do kind of, the next phase that we want to do is kind of matchmaking people who might want a mentor in the music industry, somebody that they can reach out to a couple of times and say, hey, how does this publishing or registering a song with a PRO, how does that work? Or what can I do to make my song more licensable? And so we paired up some artists in the past with different mentors, people who work at publishing companies, labels, sometimes supervisors, just to have somebody that they can bounce something off of. If they just had a question, or just a place to come if they have a question about film and TV. So that's basically what Sound Initiative is. We're adding a couple of more members now. Some people have stepped down and we're adding a couple of members, but we want it to just be a place where people go for information. And, you know, if somebody has a question like, what's a PRO? A lot of people don't know what a PRO is, a performer rights organization, and they'll confuse that with a publishing company. So just starting out with like super basics of, this is what a publishing company is and what it does. This is what a PRO is and what it does. This is what a third party licensing company is and what they do. And just start from there and try and meet people where they are. There are going to be some people who are more advanced. And for those people, we try and find a better match for them, for people who know kind of some of those basics. And then for the people who are just starting out, it's just basically like an introduction and kind of like a, is this for you? Because it's not going to be for everybody. Some people are going to be like, no, I just want to be in my artist lane and do my thing. And I don't want to, you know, write thinking about film or television. And that's totally fine. So it's just, Sound Initiative is just kind of an organization to help educate black artists about film and TV and the world of licensing and the best way to get your music licensed. That's the best way I can.
That's awesome. That's awesome, man. And for artists that are interested in like submitting for the Sound Initiative, like how could they go about doing that?
Yeah, you can just submit. I don't have the link. We can drop the link later, but you can just go on Sound Initiative submit your music, and then also just put what it is that you might be looking for out of it. Like, oh, hey, I'm looking to learn more about film and TV licensing. If you have some experience, like let's say you're somebody who's had some placements, you can list that and say, hey, I'm just looking for a third party company to represent my music. Then that's something you can submit. But just basically you can go on, submit your music, and kind of tell a little bit about yourself in a bio and what you're looking for from Sound Initiative. And then we try to help where we can. We can't always help everybody, but at least we want to be there as a source of information. So somebody might say like, hey, I'm looking for a label or a publisher, and that might be outside the realm of what we're doing in terms of, we're not really getting people signed to labels or publishing deal. It's really just information, but they can submit the music and we go through it. And right now it's towards the end of the year. So we basically meet every other month and just kind of go through the music to see like, hey, where are some people? And then make sure that the invites go out when it's time for another panel. And most of the panels are going to be like via Zoom. There's no charge or anything like that. It's just, hey, you can check it out. And we're trying to figure out if we put it on the website right now or if we just let it live on YouTube so that anybody can check it out whenever they want.
That's awesome. That's awesome, man. I love it. Like the sense of community and paying it forward, you know, because it's a lot of artists, you know, they need it.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the goal of it. And as things open up more, we want to, you know, if an artist has a show in LA and wants to invite people, we'd love to go and see and just kind of support and just kind of create that whole community of like sharing information.
Definitely. Definitely. So that's fire. So all the artists out there, shout out to y'all. Make sure y'all definitely tap in, man. You know, Sound Initiative. And I had just a couple more questions for you, man. I didn't want to take up too much of your time, man. You know, we appreciate you taking out the time, man. You know, but, you know, another question I have for you, you know, you've done so much work on you know, so many different placements. I know that you worked on Ray. You know, can you talk a little bit about that, like that whole experience? Like, how was that? Like, you know, getting the music, everything like that together for that film?
Yeah, that was a long process. We're going back to when I was still at Warner. And so that was more involved than typical because Ray Charles was an artist who was on Warner, and it was a film about Ray Charles. And so the majority of the songs that were used in the film were master rights that were controlled by Warner. And at the time that the film started, he was still alive. So it was going through the script. I think Jamie Foxx had either just been or he had just met with somebody about taking on the role. So this is early on. If the film came out in 2005, this is like 2002 maybe. So it was, you know, securing up, making sure that they knew like, all right, we have the rights for these songs, and then whoever you need to go to for the other songs, what songs they need to go for publishing, and just kind of figuring out the budget. So, and then from the label side, when something like that happens, it's so far out, but we knew like there's a major studio attached to it. Now we have Jamie Foxx attached to it. Like, it's getting closer and closer to being real because these projects come all the time and then they go away. There's projects that I've seen that the public will probably never see that, you know, start and then they get momentum and then it's like, oh, well, funding dropped out or the timing isn't right or another film came out that kind of took that spot. So what, as a label, what we were trying to do was trying to time any release. I think we were doing the Ray Charles box set and then the soundtrack for the album. So licensing all the songs, getting the fee structure together for each song to see like, all right, which songs are going to end up in the film and then what are going to be in the soundtrack? Because at the time of the film, you have no idea how big it's going to be. It could be a complete dud and go away, and then you dedicate all this time and money to it and it's for nothing, or it can be big. Because at the time, Jamie Foxx was a star, but he wasn't yet, in my opinion, a superstar. It wasn't like, hey, this is a home run, this movie's just gonna blow it out of the water. It was like, oh, they're doing a Ray Charles film. Okay, and biopics can go either way. They can be really terrible and nobody cares, or they can be big. And I feel like that was, of modern times, that and the Johnny Cash film were the two that were like, oh, these are good and got a lot of attention. So it was just kind of putting together the whatever the film studio wanted for the movie. So in that scenario, it's not a lot of pitching that's going on because they have a script and they're writing the script and they're telling us what songs they would like to use. And we're just letting them know this is what songs we have and how much it would cost for this scene, how long is the scene, and this is what it would cost. So that was a much more reactive, because it's a film and it's scripted. And those are the scenarios I try to give examples to artists of, like, in that situation, my job is to make sure that the film knows what can clear and for what budget. It's not really like, hey, send them a song there, because they know what they want. They're writing the songs to the scene. So you're not really pitching in that situation. You're just making sure things clear and clear in a timely manner. So we had the estate. Well, Ray was involved. And then, so by the time he passed, I believe all the licensing was done for the film. But if it were a situation where he was passed, then we would be dealing with the estate, you know, whoever was in charge of the estate. But he was still alive at the time. So I believe he ended up, you know, being aware of all the scenes and the descriptions and everything like that. So it was just a matter of us getting the approval, agreeing on the fees, and then licensing the song. So that was much more reactive to what the script is. There was no pitching involved in that. It was just, hey, we want this song for this scene. Can we get this song? Can we get this scene? And this is how long it is. So it was great. We ended up, the film ended up doing great. Unfortunately, Ray passed before it came out. The soundtrack did really well. Then they did like a music inspired by the soundtrack. So when you're a label, you try to milk something like that, because it ends up being like perfect timing that you can't really write. The movie came out, I think he died only a few months before the movie came out. Jamie Foxx had sampled him, which I cleared the sample for, the Kanye song that Jamie Foxx was singing on, Gold Digger. So I cleared the sample for that, but those were all just going on that we couldn't even really like plan anything out like that if we wanted to. It would be great if we could, but we couldn't plan that Kanye West was going to sample Ray Charles, and then Gold Digger was going to come out, and then Georgia On My Mind was going to be sampled by Ludacris, I think, at the time. So it was just like Ray was in the atmosphere, and then the movie came out, and it was just kind of everywhere. So it was just, a lot of times, you know, labels would love to recreate something like that, but it's like lightning in a bottle. You can't really plan something like that. I've worked on a million other film projects that came and went that if I named them, people would be like, what's that? But Ray is just one where everything just worked out perfectly.
Yeah, that's a fact, man. Yeah, the movie, classic movie from start to finish. You know, I think Jamie just killed that role. Like, that was phenomenal. Like, his acting was top tier. And the music, like you said, you know, with the Kanye sample, Luda. So, yeah, sometimes that's just how it works. It's like there's no rhyme or reason behind it. It's just everything is just hitting. All the cylinders are just kicking at the same time. So, yeah, solid.
You just want to be prepared for that. But it's not something that you can plan for. Even like right now, a lot of people are talking about the Kate Bush use in Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, now that song is everywhere. And I still have a lot of friends at Warner, the label that has the song. And then they also use Metallica in the Stranger Things. And the film and TV people are constantly getting hit up by the marketing people and kind of the higher ups that are like, okay, what's our next Stranger Things use? And their response is always like, we have no idea. Like, we didn't write the script. We just received the request and made sure that things went out in a timely manner. But that wasn't anything we had control over. And it's not something that you can really bank on, because from a label's perspective, they got that for a song from 1985. So sales got, you know, obviously boosted because of that. It was everywhere. People were interviewing Kate Bush about it and the music supervisor, and everybody's talking about it, but they couldn't plan for that. So from a marketing perspective, they'll say, oh, well, what about this artist? What about Phil Collins? What about this? And it's like, well, we're not writing the script. So that, in that case, we're just basically servicing the the film or the TV show and it works out, and that's great. And the best thing that you can do is make sure that the supervisor knows that you work fast and that you'll get, you know, a fair market value for the song, because you always want to maximize it, but that you'll be easy and reasonable to work with. But it's not something that you can like plan for.
Yeah, I kind of think a lot of times that's what people, they mess up. Like, they try to recreate something. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing, you know? Like, it just is what it is, you know? So
you just want to be prepared for it, but you can't anticipate it. And that's, sync is kind of like that in general. You want to be prepared for it, but it's really difficult to count on it just because there's so many people involved in selecting a song that ends up in a TV show. It's not just the supervisor. The editor might be involved. The director might be involved. There might be a lot of people in the room that say, oh, and then at the last minute, oh, we like this song better. And then they go with it for no reason, nothing wrong with the other song. They just found another song that they like better. And they put it to picture and they move forward with it. So the best thing that you can do is be prepared, but not like start. I tell artists that I work with all the time, don't like plan your bills around licensing, because it just, you really can't do that. It's so up and down. It's so, you might get 5 licenses this week and then you might not get any more licenses the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Or you might not get it for 6 months. And, you know, then even getting paid on licenses, I always tell artists it's usually 90 to 120 days from when a project airs. So if a film came out today, you're not going to get paid for 90 to 120 days. They have that in the contract. Sometimes it pays a little sooner, but in general, it's in the agreement. They have that time because, like you mentioned earlier, there's so many songs in a project. Mm-hmm. When you get I wish artists could see like the cue sheet, because they will focus on their song, but every song that's in there has to be accounted for and paid, and they have to make sure that everything is done right. All the PROs are contacted. And all of those have to be in order, including, you know, the score pieces that may be in there. They might have a composer that's a part of the film. They might license a piece of music that has a sample in there. So all of those things have to be in order and everything has to be right from the publishing to the PRO. So it takes time to get everything. And you're dealing with a huge machine like Universal Pictures or NBC or so they have to put everything in order, make sure it's organized, and then pay everybody. So the best thing to do is try to get, you know, as much music out there as possible that fits for film and TV, and then know that you've done your job and go focus on something else, but not sit around and wait for placement, because you'll go crazy and it might not come.
Yeah, that's a big gem. That's a big gem, man. You know, so I got 2 more questions for you, man. I'm gonna shift gears a little bit because I know you're a hip hop head. Know you love hip hop, right? So my question is, top 5 dead alive, what's your list? Who are your top 5 MCs that, like, those are your guys or girls, right?
Let's see. I'll go 5-1. 5 is Pac. 4 is Nas. 3 is Cube. 2 is Rakim. And 1 is KRS.
There you have it. There you have it, man. Blastmaster. Yes, man.
I could strongly consider naming my company Criminal Minded. It's my all-time favorite album, regardless of genre.
Oh, yeah, man. Listen, KRS, Scott LaRock, man. I remember bumping KRS, man, like yesterday, you know, and I still bump them, you know, to this day, but I just like, you know, no shade to like modern rap, you know, in different types of content, but you know, the era I came up in, like, I love content based hip hop. So I like dudes that they got something to say, and you know, they could do it over any type of beat, you know. So that's definitely
my favorite thing, is being able to tell a story, no matter, that's just the basics of songwriting, regardless of genre, hip hop, country. Like, when you have the great storytellers, Bob Marley, KRS-One, John Lennon, Stevie Wonder, Prince.
There's
a reason that they're on that, you know, pedestal, is they have great songs, and you listen to the stories and you go, damn, that's an incredible, well-written story. From, you know, Eminem, Stan, to Ghetto Boys, Mind Playing Tricks on Me. Kendrick's a great storyteller. Like, that applies across the board. When you could tell a great story, that song can go a long way and really just like really stick with people. So those are my five favorites. You know, I'll break it up into eras, like, all right, you know, 80s, 90s, 2000, but if it had to just be all time, those are my five guys.
Got you. That's fine. And then, all right, I want to do a part two of that. Give me five groups, five hip hop groups, man.
Five hip hop groups. Let me see. Public Enemy, Wu-Tang, N.W.A., Outkast, and then Run-DMC.
There you go. Yeah.
I can't leave off Run-DMC. That's the Beatles of hip hop.
Yep. That's it. That's it, man. Yep. They killed it, man. So
shout out to De La Tribe too.
You know what's funny? I thought you was gonna say Tribe. I thought you was gonna say Tribe. But
there's six of them, you know.
I
can keep going. It's the Roots. Like,
they're
so those are my five though.
Yeah. Fire, man. Yeah. All those cats, man. Like, they just keeping hip hop alive, man. You know what I'm saying? Nas just put out some new fire. That King's Disease 3 is hitting, yeah. So that's tough.
Hit-Boy worked really well together. I love to see it. I love to see, you know, Hit-Boy being from here, Nas being from the East Coast, coming together and doing it. It reminds me of when Cube and Bomb Squad got together. And
Magic.
So I love to see that series and, you know, kind of creating a whole story where it's just a book of Hit-Boy and Nas that you could just check out this point in their career.
Yep. Fire.
You saw, with Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson, just like, oh, hey, here's this producer and this vocalist together. What can they create? So I love seeing that.
Yeah, that's when the magic happens, man. So, all right. So, you know, I had one last question for you, and that is, like, we ask every guest on the show, what is your mantra? I got two personally, like, mine's, my first one is persistence wears down resistance. So that's pretty much a testament to never giving up. You know, there's no losses, only lessons. And, you know, just staying consistent with what you want. My second one is collaboration is greater than competition. So always building with like-minded people. You know, your network is your net worth. So for all the listeners out there, like, what is your mantra that you would say keeps you going?
Well, that's a good one. It's probably going to be a lyric. you know, one of my favorites is it's a simple one. If you don't work, you can't eat. It's a Dub C in the Mad Circle song. And that's simple. That if you don't work, you can't eat. That's just, you know, I could see my pop saying something like that. I could see my grandpa saying something like that. I could see, you know, a young kid saying like that. It's simple. If you don't work, you don't put in the work, then you don't get the fruits of that labor.
That's a fact.
I think you can apply that across the board for anybody, and it's something that anybody can relate to. I tell it to my kid, like, you're not going to get the benefit. You can't want to be Steph Curry if you don't want to put in those hours.
That's a fact.
So if you don't work, you can't eat.
That's a fact, man. I love it, man. I love it. Well, you know, for all the listeners, man, you know, we just appreciate, man, you tapping in with us, man. And I got to pause. I got to say shout out to the listeners because, you know, we started the show, man. Most recently, we in the top 100 Apple podcasts for music interviews. And just this week, we hit the number one slot in Italy for music interviews. So shout out to all the listeners, man. All the musicians on a global scale, man. And we just really want to thank you, man, for your time, man. We just appreciate you just taking out the time, sharing your knowledge, sharing your wisdom, man. We appreciative for that, King.
No problem, man. Congratulations on your success and much continued success for you. I appreciate you having me on.
Most definitely, man. And for all the listeners out there, if they want to follow you on social media or, you know, they want to check out your company, like, where can they go online to check it out?
Yeah, I'm on all the social media platforms. I mean, who knows what's going to happen with Twitter, but, you know.
That's a fact.
I'm still on Twitter for business purposes or to complain about my sports teams. And so you can find me, Tarek Bradford. I'm on social media, and usually I keep that one just kind of like more light and fun. And then my business one is Dahomey Music. And usually I just share music industry information or projects that I'm working on. And then Instagram, usually I'll post on there. My business page is just Dahomey Music. And I usually share new music that I represent, catalog that I represent, and also placements that I represent. So Instagram is the one that I probably interact the most with for business. And so, yeah, I'm on all those social platforms, either under my name, Tarik Bradford, which is just my personal one. So if you want to see pictures of me hanging out with my kid, or if you want to, for the business purposes, the Homie Music, you can just see kind of what I'm working on and what I'm representing. And I just try to also share just, you know, any nuggets about music industry stuff that's coming up that I think is important, that I think is something to pay attention to. So Twitter, Instagram, I'm out there.
Definitely, man. Well, you know, like I said, we appreciate you, and just, you know, we definitely tapped in, and, you know, we just going to keep an eye out, man, for all the great things you're doing.
All right, man. Good to meet you. And thanks for reaching out. I appreciate it. You guys take care.
Most definitely, man. Until next week, y'all. Peace.